I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. People in Sarajevo still refer to the siege of their city in the early 90s as the eternal nightmare. From 1992 to 1996, city residents, many of them Muslim, lived a life of fear and deprivation as Serb forces cut off supplies into the city and terrorized the people with mortar and sniper fire. Over 10,000 people are thought to have died in the city in that time. One of the reporters who helped tell that story is NPR's Scott Simon, the host of Weekend Edition Saturday. Scott worked several stints in Sarajevo, filing stories on the lives of people stuck inside the city. One young woman he met was Irina Milic.
I don't know, do you understand? This war has no sense, you know? And everyone who fights is fighting for nothing, because I think that there's no end of this, you know? And all young people got killed. A lot of my friends, my ages, you know? There's a lot of boys that had 16 years. He was also in the army of Bosnia and Herzegovina. And he got killed. What for? What for? You answer me, please.
According to the definitions by which people are being killed in Bosnia today, Irina Milic is nothing in particular, and everything the opponents of a multicultural Bosnia revile. Her father is a Serb who now serves at the age of 46 in the Bosnian army. Her mother is a Muslim. At the age of 15 going on 16, Irina Milic considers herself both and neither, and wonders where any map redrawn for Bosnia would send the Milic family.
Scott Simon decided to address some of those unanswered questions, not with more reporting, but with a new novel, a fictional mix of what was going on at that time in that city with those people, and his own storytelling skills and imagination. The result is a book called Pretty Birds, and it is a haunting and powerful trip back into the siege of Sarajevo. Scott's here this hour. We'd like to have you join us in a conversation about storytelling. What can you do with fiction that you can't do with real people in real time and real places? And some of the very best stories in American fiction are those told of people in the time of the Depression and in wars that were very real. And so what happens when you mix such strong memories with imagination? Can you paint an even more evocative picture? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Scott Simon's joining us now from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Scott, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Dick. Thank you for asking me.
I know that you have covered a lot of war zones in different parts of the world, but I get the impression, in large part from reading the book, that there's something about this city of Sarajevo that clearly got to you.
Yeah, I love Sarajevo. I love cities. I love the energy, the diversity, the way that there are crossroads, people from all over that area or that particular country, all over the world frequently in a place like Boston, New York, London, Chicago, San Francisco, I should say, while I'm sitting here, come and they often come to cities to change their lives. And so I really made an emotional connection with Sarajevo when I got there, because Sarajevo has always defined itself as a crossroads in that area of the world, and proud of their diversity, proud of the way that people would come there from the country and try something they couldn't back home. And the ethnic mix certainly impressed me for that area of the world. And I must also say this was I just emotionally connected to the city and the people. I loved the sense of humor. This was a city of theater goers, city folk, theater goers and espresso drinkers and, I must say, cigarette smokers and, people who would declaim and debate loudly in taverns and then kiss each other on both times on the cheeks and then go home. And I loved all that. And
talk
the,
a little bit
the
more
whole
about
idea.
This sense of humor that you just sort of mentioned offhand, because it's something you play with a lot in your book. And there's something strange about a sense of humor that comes up in as many different people who are suffering in the way that they're suffering.
Well, a sense of humor is often the only armament they have left. And this was, I think, particularly true in Sarajevo, which, remember, was immediately there was an arms embargo imposed on that area of the world. And that had the practical effect of leaving the Serbs, who had the old Yugoslav National Army, in possession of all the artillery, all the heavy guns, most of the rifles. And the mostly Muslim quarter and mixed ethnic population of Sarajevo with nothing. So they were left defenseless, I must say, save for their sense of wit and humor. And it was extraordinary, and it was one of the reasons why I would come back from Sarajevo, to be sure, filled with a certain amount of woe and touched by, touched by the suffering that I had in the smallest degree shared and certainly been in touch with and tried to report to the world, but also enlivened by the energy, the sense of humor, the ingenuity of people there was just extraordinary. And Sarajevo jokes. Our driver came to us one day and said, Scotty, I saw Jesus Christ walking down Vashe Miskin Street. He was carrying his cross. I said, what did you say to him? I said, listen, can I have the wood? I would like to make a fire for coffee. extraordinary. So I found myself, no doubt about it, falling in love with that city and those people and wanting to eventually create something that would have some shelf life, some permanent testament to what I saw.
I want to talk more about that, but I want to prevail on you to read a passage from Pretty Birds. It's the sure. The place where the Zarich family is all bunked down for the evening. Do you know the one that I'm talking about?
Yes, exactly. And they're sleeping in the front room under the windows because, of course, if they move farther back into the room, they could be exposed to sniper fire and artillery fire that night. So this is a group of people like everyone in the city who are living through daily sniper fire, artillery fire, hunger, and danger. So they're bedded down for the night. Irena is the daughter. Milan and Dalia are the parents and their neighbor, Alexandra. The mortar fire and sniping were especially intense that night. Alexandra came up from her apartment to sleep with the Zariches in their living room. That was what they now called Grandma's apartment. Irena found it comic and uncomfortable to sleep in the same room as her parents. When she shifted or flinched, as she did a couple of times, screamed in her sleep, her mother would roll over and take her flailing arms into her own hands. She thought Irena looked like a kitten twitching in her sleep. Irena cried out that night. Mrs. Zarich awoke first, but she couldn't make out the words. She crawled over and held Irena, who was trembling. "What's wrong?" she asked. "What's wrong?" Irena stirred. Then she began to laugh. She thrummed her fist against her chest. "You're laughing," said Mrs. Zarich. "What's wrong?" "What's wrong?" said Irena. "Say that again, mother." "What's wrong?" Mr. Zarich had pulled himself up on his elbows, and he too began to laugh. "Again, Dalia, dear," he said. "Listen to yourself. Think about each word. What's wrong? What's wrong? What's wrong?" Alexandra, Irena, and her father laughed harder. Mrs. Jarrett suddenly raised a hand to her forehead. "Oh, I understand now," she said. "Yes, that's pretty funny. What's wrong? Oh, nothing special." She was finally laughing. She laughed so much that she decided she needed a cigarette to settle her breathing and fumbled around on the floor for anyone's pack of Drinas. "What's wrong? What's wrong? What's wrong?" Irena repeated the words drowsily, as if they were the refrain of a favorite song. She could see the orange veins of mortar round scoring the sky as she laughed herself to sleep like a child.
That's the familiar voice of Scott Simon reading from his new book, Pretty Birds. And Scott, the Irena that you model your main character on here, we heard her voice at the beginning of the program. How much of this Irena is that Irena?
You know, I've about 15%, some physical traits that they share, and I'd say the ethnic mixture of the family too, although they shouldn't be confused with the same characters. I might also say too that if this is a Irena Milic, the real person that you heard talk about, what is this water for? It is nothing. You will tell me, please, nothing. A few months later, when we profiled her again, she was asking the United States to start bombing the other side of Sarajevo. So her attitude shifted, and so I take the character a couple years beyond even that. But I began. The character is named Irena, which is firstly a very common name in central Bosnia, but it's in tribute to the real-life teenager who introduced us to other teenagers in Sarajevo. Because one of the things that fascinated me about the place is, you know, during the day, during the siege, the city was in a sense ruled by teenagers. Adults were cooped up in their apartments, and the teenagers were the ones who really grew restless, and they were the ones who would take to the streets and bring back water, bring back bags of beans when humanitarian supplies were available. They were the ones who would take chances out on the street. So it was almost uncommon to run into someone on the street who was above the age of 18 or 19.
Tell me why it is, and people do remember your stories from there. Tell me why it is that you chose to take it kind of in a different direction and go with fiction instead of writing nonfiction.
A lot of good nonfiction books have been written about the siege of Sarajevo in central Bosnia, and I like a good many of them. Roger Cohen's Hearts Turned Brutal. My colleague Tom Jelton did a wonderful book about the Sarajevo Daily newspaper that continued to publish called Sarajevo Daily. I wanted to get behind the other side of the door. I know in journalism, no matter how well we think we know a story, no matter how well we get to know some people who we interview and spend time with, at some point we leave. And the door closes, and they're left to themselves. And although I think occasionally they can confide something to strangers or visitors, as we were in Sarajevo, there's clearly a whole aspect of their lives that go on without us looking, without us being enlisted in it as witnesses. And I wanted to get on that other side of the door as much as I could. You know, because in the end, reporters don't have the same stake in the story. Even if when we're there, we also have to worry about sniper fire and artillery fire. We don't really have to worry about the outcome the way that we do. And I wanted to write something that would pierce onto that other side, which is also why I don't have a reporter in the story. You know, I don't center it around someone coming in from the outside.
All right, Connection listeners. Does a story like this take you to the other side of the door in the way that nonfiction can't do that? Does it give you a deeper or closer understanding on what goes on in a war zone from someone who clearly knows very well what goes on in a war zone? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My guest is Scott Simon. His new book is called Pretty Birds. We're back right after the break. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. This hour with Scott Simon, we're talking about his new novel, Pretty Birds, which uses a mix of fiction and reality to take us back to the streets of Sarajevo when that city was under siege. Now, I have to tell you, some war correspondents have an eye just for the facts. The better ones have an ear for the stories that they tell, how it is that people in even the most awful circumstances, in a place like Sarajevo, can still find a way to attach themselves to the rest of the world. The characters do it in the same way that the rest of us do, through pop culture, magazines, the music of the time. And I want to just hear once again a moment from a story that Scott Simon filed in the summer of 1993. Once again, we're listening to the voice of that 15-year-old Irina Milic.
She calls out to the man on the street, "Sir, can you help me? It's cold and I'm nowhere to sleep. Is there some way you can tell me? Oh, think twice. It's just another day for you and me in paradise. Oh, think twice. It's just another day for you, you and me in paradise."
And Scott, you do such an elegant job in the story of finding a place for that music and attaching those teenagers to what mattered to them, because we never think of them doing that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no. But of course, it struck and touched me while I was there that pop culture was very important to them. It was a way of keeping their humanity going. You know, it was a way of keeping their interest in the outside world going. I mean, the amount of interest there was among people who were besieged in Princess Diana and Prince Charles getting divorced,
right.
The tragic murder of Michael Jordan's father, Madonna, who and her book Sex had just come out, and people would ask me had I seen it. They regretted that they couldn't see it. If you remember that book that came out, Madonna,
yes.
And the interest in Madonna and Sting and the Clash, you know, and. When the siege began in 1992, the city was pitched into a kind of time capsule. So the same magazines that were there in 1992 were there in 1994, 1995, because new ones did not come in, and those didn't leave. So people passed them around, and magazines that you would once read casually and cast aside were read and reread, so that the captions almost, you could quote them almost like Holy Scripture. And I will never forget you know, being there and reading something like a lipstick ad in a British fashion magazine, and the lip cream promises protection against all the hard elements, you know, and there you are with sniper and artillery fire, and you naturally say, well, gee, I wonder, maybe I should just cover myself with this lipstick if it works that well. It changes your, you know, altogether changes your perspective, and it was an important part of keeping the intellectual and emotional side of their lives going, and not overwhelmed by suffering.
Why did you choose to cast your arena as a sniper? It's such a cold-blooded thing to be in a place like that.
Well, I suppose it's a cold-blooded thing to be anywhere, and I must say, to do it well, you have to be cold-blooded. You also need eye-hand coordination and a certain amount of athletic skills and patience and precision. But one thing I learned is that you're not, as a generalization, trained to actually shoot at someone. Even if you have to put a bullet in what's called the kill zone, you shoot at a spot. You don't shoot at somebody's heart. You find a spot on their tunic where their heart would be behind, and you shoot at that spot. And I guess I went with a sniper as my principal character, a young woman who becomes a sniper, for a couple of reasons. I was it was the only form of defense that was even moderately available to Muslim and mixed ethnic Sarajevans to fight back and try and let the people on the other side of the line know that they simply weren't going to acquiesce silently in their own destruction. But also, you know, snipers are in roosts above the city. They inhabited the bones of bombed out and abandoned buildings, and they had a view of the city from on high, looking down on people as they tried to go about their daily lives. That I think just wasn't safely available to other people. And I was fascinated with that kind of literally bird's eye view that you would have of the city. And of course, when you're up there, you realize that the green line, which is where the city was divided, you get up there, you can see across it, but you know, it's the old story that the lines that we draw as human beings suddenly often aren't visible when we get above them.
And that view was available. I mean, you could have probably seen it from your room at the Holiday Inn. You probably could have seen it from the mm-hmm. apartment windows of the people who you visited, right? That
yeah,
eerie.
But I wouldn't spend hours looking out the way snipers do, because if you spend really even more than a few minutes, you afford yourself a chance to be seen and someone to settle on you as a target. So you remember in that old Holiday Inn where what used to be the most desirable rooms with a view of the mountains became the least desirable rooms because they were the ones most exposed to sniper fire on the other side. But, you know, snipers hide, and therefore they look for hours, endless hours, down at the city.
Scott Simon is my guest this hour. We're talking about his new book, Taking Us Back to Sarajevo. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. We're going to go to Charlottesville, Virginia, for a call from Vanessa. Hi, Vanessa.
Good evening. Good morning, actually. My name is Vanessa, and I was calling regarding the book. It's really nice, and I'm really glad that a book will come out. I would just say hello to everyone. My name is actually Vanessa, and I am from Bosnia. I came to Virginia 4 years ago, 5 years ago. I've been to Sarajevo many times. I lived there for a while during the siege, and I'm one of the teenagers that they were there at the time. And it's really amazing for us, for me personally, to hear that someone could go that deep in the soul of Bosnians at the time. So I'm looking forward to the book, of course. And that is the only reason why I called. I was just wanted to let know to a reporter that they are the people that they came out, and which is really great, and which is really good. And it's really good to have all of those reporters. They were there at the time because they could take our words somewhere outside, which is really great.
Do you remember, Vanessa, I'm just wondering if you remember from back at that time the feeling that people had of almost being betrayed by the rest of the world, because everybody knew what was going on and it seemed like nobody was doing anything about it. Do you recall that?
Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, I would say that all of the people, young people of my age, they become such professionals in politics and everything that was going around at the time. We did lose our faith. I think it was just a hope that kept people alive and just hope that it's going to end soon. So, but I think that we did and we still do feel betrayed by whole Europe and the whole world. And it was really amazing that how could things like that could happen in the country and anywhere in the world, and nobody would really react. So that is why we felt the pleasure, and we were so grateful to these brave people that they were there, journalists and people from all over the world, that they were risking their own lives just to tell our story. It's really something. It's really amazing.
Although, Scott, you always knew that there was a home that you would be going to, even if you were spending weeks in Sarajevo, right?
Yes, of course, and which is why I say, although we would be, you know, we would be exposed to sniper and artillery fire. Obviously, we came in with money; we could buy food on the black market. Hunger was not the danger to us. We knew that if we survived all the elements there, we would go back to a safe and snug home. And also, we didn't have a stake in the outcome. I grew to think that all of the world and civilization had a stake in the outcome. But of course, the people living in Sarajevo had to worry about what would happen if they couldn't hold out. What if the Serbian paramilitaries did roll over them? You know, because people, Muslims and people of mixed ethnic background had surrendered in other parts of the country, and they were slaughtered by Serb paramilitary units. I have one of my characters in the book say, well, what do you think would happen if we did give up? Do you think they'd give us box lunches and send us to a health spa? And of course, we saw scores of thousands of people were slaughtered. And, you know, no reporter had to worry about that.
Anessa, are you still there?
Oh, yes, I am.
I'm wondering, in your view, thinking back at that time, what people might learn about what it was Bosnians went through, if they get a chance to read about it in a fictional story like the one we're describing on the program today, if that will tell them something that maybe just going back to, you know, the news reports and the old documentaries, if it can be a little bit different.
It's, as a matter of fact, that is the great idea, the greatest idea that I've heard lately ever. It's some things that make us feel not being a number, or it could be another way. I've been reading a lot since I came here. I cannot resist. I would rather read something else, not really about us all the time. But I think that could be something what we needed, some kind of fiction, something that might be done different, or just imagine how it would be if. We will just become something different, not really a number, not really a group of unfortunate people on a picture, on a scary picture. So it would be really nice. It's a great idea.
Scott? Mm-hmm.
I love to hear that, because that's exactly what I want to do in Pretty Birds. I want people to get to know a group of people who will continue to inhabit their lives and to care about them as characters and as people after they've turned the last page. If this isn't improper, Dick, is it possible? I there are so many Bosnians living in the United States, and as far as I'm concerned, none of them should have to pay for a copy of Pretty Birds. I want to buy everyone a copy of Pretty Birds. And if Anissa could talk to one of your producers, I'd like her address. I would like to send her a signed copy of the book.
Yeah, we will certainly see if we can arrange that. She's not on the line right now, but the miracles of modern technology, I'm sure, will help us out there. And Anissa, if you're still listening, maybe you just want to give us a ring back and make sure that we've got your particulars on that. It's a nice offer. Thanks for that. 1-800-423-8255. Scott Simon is my guest. We're talking about his new book, Pretty Birds. And before we spoke with Anissa, we were talking about this work of the sniper. I'm going to put you back to work again and ask you to take us to Irena's perch, where she is sort of waiting out the time. And I'll let you set it up.
Okay. She's been up in her perch, and she has one bullet left. She would be issued five, and the instructions were essentially use them all, don't go over. Can't go over, I suppose, but use them all, because you don't want to be up there and not use them all. And even if you don't find what we'd call a target of value, the whole idea would be to fire a shot that would let people know that there are people on the other side who aren't going to acquiesce in their own destruction. So Irena's in her roost. It's getting close to dawn. Irena saw a glint of yellow gleaming against a gray street. At first she thought it was a tennis ball fallen away from a child's game, abandoned in an alley. But when she sharpened her gaze through her scope, she could see that it was a lemon, then another, then a whole crate of 50 opened like a pirate's hoard of doubloons. Lemons from Crete, she guessed. Lemons that used to be so plentifully and casually squeezed into drinks and dressings, sliced and strewn to wreathe lamb roasts. She guessed that a black market trader had brought them in from Montenegro, trucked them up to be sold to Serb soldiers in their posts who had not seen lemons for months. Irena wouldn't want to shoot at a man standing in line to buy a lemon, but she wouldn't mind trying to hit a man who would sell lemons for the price of beefsteak. If she hit the man trying to buy a lemon, she could live with the consequences. He had more money than was suitable. Lemons were for seasoning and adornment, not nourishment. If he was standing in line to buy a lemon, it was probably because he didn't need to stand in line to buy milk or meat. If he didn't need to stand in line for food, it must be because he was a bully who was eating off the plates of Muslims who used to be his neighbors. So if a shoulder should come into Irena's scope, a pair of flashing hands, she wouldn't worry too much about who was selling lemons and who was buying them. She would pull in her breath and let it out slowly. When the air in her lungs rolled out, she would squeeze the trigger just under her chin and wait for the jolt against her shoulder. For long minutes, though, she saw only lemons. She raised herself a couple of inches carefully by squeezing her buttocks against the floor, trying to sight more. But the man selling lemons had opened the crate in an alley behind Dinarska Street that was guarded from view by a two-story garage. She could fire through the wire-screen sides of the structure, but her bullet would likely strike only an abandoned, burned-out car or smash against an unseen wall or floor. The sun was beginning to get higher and brighter. The lemon seemed almost to hiss with the morning's first low light. Irena trained her sight on the top of the mound, then counted 1, 2, 3 lemons to the right, because she felt a mild wind blowing down from the mountains in the east. She stopped breathing. The Night, who was a DJ on the radio, the Night was playing, "The further on I go, the less I know. Friend or foe, there's only us." She squeezed her breath out gently, as if she wanted to make a candle flame tremble. She tickled the trigger almost tenderly, as if she were rubbing the underside of a kitten's chin, and then squeezed it just as gently until there was a jerk against her jaw that jolted clear into her shoulder. She kept her gaze focused through her sight as if she could guide the shot. Within a second, she saw lemons jumping and quaking in their crate like minced garlic on a scalding skillet. They tumbled as the overturned trash can in which they had been set whined and tipped over into the alley. Lemons spilled past people scrambling over the street for a place to hide. Irena's pigeon skipped a step and strutted with involuntary alarm. But over the past few months, pigeons, too, had learned to snap back quickly on alert. "Pretty bird," Irena said softly. "I'm sorry to disturb you."
Pretty Birds is the name of the book. Scott Simon is the writer and my guest this hour. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Taking a call next from Charleston, South Carolina. Michelle's on the line. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. This question may be more personal than Mr. Simon wants to respond to. But first, thank you. I had many driveway moments listening to your coverage and unable to leave until your report finished. It was quite something. You reminded me of Chris Hedges, the reporter who covered war for many years and wrote about the effect of it on himself. And I can't help but wonder about the effect on you and your faith. I believe I heard somewhere that you're a Quaker.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered,
yes.
I wondered if it was possible for you to speak about how much of an effect this war, and I know you also covered El Salvador, had on yourself and your faith, and if you want to answer it.
Yeah, I'll answer it briefly, though, you know, because in the end, I'm not here to talk about my faith. I've written a novel that reflects a great deal of other faiths. I don't mind saying I'm a Quaker. The war in Bosnia made me question the tenets of Quaker pacifism, because I could not see a pacifist solution to the war in Bosnia, to the assault of Serb paramilitaries on Muslims in Sarajevo and mixed ethnic groups there, any more than I think after fill in the blank 1937, 1939, I think much of the world could see a pacifist solution to the trepidations of Adolf Hitler. Even if he had not invaded Poland, he obviously was slaughtering people within Germany. And it fundamentally shook up my convictions about the world, and undoubtedly some of my characters deal with that, because Bosnians had an ambition to be what they called an unarmed Leninist, as in John Lennon state. They felt if they didn't have an army, they wouldn't be attacked, and alas, that turned out not to be the case.
There's no question that when you cover stories like that, they do cause you to question some of the most very basic things that you hold dear. Scott Simon is my guest. We're talking about his new book, Pretty Birds. taking us back to the time when Sarajevo was the city under siege. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And a little bit about how you can exploit fiction to tell stories in ways that even nonfiction and the best storytellers in nonfiction can't do. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Scott Simon is my guest. We're talking about his new book. It's called Pretty Birds. It takes us back to Sarajevo. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, to Plymouth, Massachusetts, for a call from Miriam. Hi, Miriam.
Hello, Scott. Thank you for taking my call. I'm listening to the story of someone who was not a victim or a perpetrator, who gets to write in the voices of victims and perpetrators of the siege of Sarajevo. And I'm so interested in this because as a writer, I have tried to do the same thing. I wasn't even there, but the stories that came to me so moved me that I felt inclined, compelled to write. So I'll take my answer off the air, but I'd love to hear some discussion of where we get our authority, how we assume the authority to write in these voices that are not our own, about something so personal and so immediate in our history.
Go ahead, Scott.
Well, I guess that's the art of fiction, is enlisting your imagination and mating imagination to a certain amount of knowledge, but trying to inhabit somebody else's skin, somebody else's mind. And then if you kind of apprehend the character that way, I really think that words and voices, you know, not voices muttering to go forth and save friends, but voices of characters begin to come in your mind, and you can give them voice. I mean, that to me was when it worked, and I hope the result is apparent in the book. That was one of the most satisfying and wonderful discoveries that I made. That's what made the creative enterprise very worth it for me, to be able to inhabit the minds and skins of people, sometimes even people I didn't feel close to. But inevitably, when you inhabit them a little bit, you begin to take on their perspective somewhat. And I found that rewarding, and I just hope it rings valid in this novel.
I'm wondering if you found it easy or liberating to do that. I mean, all your work as a journalist is about taking real people and helping them use their words to tell their stories. And then when you switch over to the fictional world, is it like, now I can finally say what they ought to have been saying all along, or is it harder?
It's both. There is no doubt about it, Richard. There is that aspect of liberation, you know, where you say, boy, I can use language in a way I haven't before. I can use some words that I would never say on the air that I'm sure a lot of people don't think I know, but I've heard them in the street and I've repeated them in this book. And yet at the same time, it's also very hard because I think it has to, you know, there has to be the discipline of truth. There has to be the discipline of validity. And there's an enormous responsibility in trying to fairly reflect a character, particularly in a story like this that I hope has great emotional impact. And it's an exacting process. You know, it's totally absorbing. We have a 2-year-old. And it's absorbing in the way 2-year-olds can be totally absorbing. You know, when I was writing it, particularly for the month off I took, my wife and I, it was the characters were partners with us. You know, they inhabited the dinner table. They were there at breakfast. We became very fond of them, but, you know, you don't always want to hear them. You can't turn them off and on.
Let's go to Dorchester, Massachusetts, for another call. This one's from Jordan. Hi, Jordan.
Hi, Dick. Nice to talk to you and to hear Scott's voice again. I'd like to say that early in that war, it was difficult to figure out who the bad guys were. Very early in that war, there were Serbs, Bosnians, Muslims, and I heard a news report saying that a Serb sniper killed a couple of Muslims who were trying to feed starving animals in the Sarajevo Zoo. Mm. And that clarified the situation for me. I knew right away that the Serbs were the bad guys, and I never forgot that. So that's all I have to say.
It's interesting, though, that the zoo and the animals are also a part, Scott, of your own writing and your own experience there.
And an important... I love animals, as you know, maybe some people have inferred over the years from our show, and the plight of the Sarajevo Zoo and the plight of house pets in Sarajevo. I think the story we did years ago that I think still continues to get a lot of mention from people who remember it is about the extraordinary lengths that people in Sarajevo went through to keep their pets alive, the dogs and cats and birds, because they were part of the family and it was an aspect of their humanity that they didn't want to cast aside. And I detail a bit what happened in the Sarajevo Zoo. I set a scene there, which I hope will exemplify a lot of what went on. I should explain, too, and I understand how we fall into shorthand of Serbs and Muslims, but about 20% of the people who lived on the Muslim side of Sarajevo were Serbs. And they were Serbs who pointedly didn't want to be part of some greater ethnically defined Serb republic, but wanted to be part of a multi-ethnic democracy called Bosnia. And you know, that's something that, in a sense, you can't repeat enough. So the lines were never ethnic.
And I'm reminded when I hear Jordan's question about good guys and bad guys too, that made it up, you know, with the exception of certain moments in Sarajevo, it made the coverage of that entire period of time extremely difficult because there were atrocities being committed on both sides. And it wasn't that easy to say these people are wearing the white uniforms and these ones are wearing the black uniforms, you know?
Secretary of State Baker very famously said, "We don't have a dog in that fight." Words which I believed he said that he has come to regret over the years. And it must be noted that when a new administration came into office, although they thought that the United States did have a dog in that fight, they didn't do much to help the dog. I understand that this was baffling to a lot of people. Those names have no vowels in them. It was difficult to tell the difference between them. It was often difficult from a distance to feel a stake of what went on there. I do think, though, that it used to be an item of some despair to me when I would come back and people would say, "Oh, those people have been fighting each other for five centuries." In fact, in central Bosnia and in Sarajevo, the story was that people had been getting along for five centuries, yeah, in this mixed ethnic stew of the city. And it was only when Serbia came under the grip of what I think can fairly be identified as a racist expansionist regime that the plight of Sarajevo was on the table and before the eyes of the world.
Tell me a little bit more, though, about what you understood, how you came to understand war by looking at the way people related to their pets. Because you've got this character, Irena, who, in effect, steps by the body of her dead grandmother in order to find a safe place to live and remains captivated by the health and safety of a gray parrot. And I mean, that's pretty close to what was going on in the city at the time. What does it tell us?
I think that with pets, and one of the wonderful utilities of their companionship in our lives is that they can help us to evince and come to grips with emotions in a way we won't let ourselves when the people around us die. I think when Irena steps over her grandmother and for all of the characters in those first few days of the war, they understood that, in a sense, they didn't have the time to cry. They didn't have the time to wrestle with their sense of loss because they had to survive. But when the safety of a house pet, someone who's an absolutely vulnerable, innocent companion in your family, is an issue, you allow yourself, the facade cracks, the vulnerability. Suddenly, your feelings spill open, and you permit yourself to do that. And in a sense, it's obviously at that point you're crying not just for the house pet, but in a sense the accumulation of fatigue and sadness and woe that's begun to dominate your life. And that's why people identify so strongly with animals, because in the end they reflect the benefits and sometimes deficits of our own companionship. And why I love having. Yeah, that's why I love having them as characters in this book, because I think it really speaks exactly to the way people live.
And emphasizes what it is that people deny in terms of, not facing the death or not facing the rape or not facing the murder that you've seen, right?
Exactly. I mean, it's impossible to write a story about the war in Bosnia without touching on the subject of rape. And it was when this would occur, you know, as people in Sarajevo would say to me, look, if this were in peacetime, we'd go to a psychiatrist and there would be encounter groups, but we can't do that now. So what we do is pretend it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. We just don't talk about it. Someday maybe we will. Now, no doubt, I'm sure a lot of psychiatrists listen to The Connection and they'll call in to say that's very unhealthy.
Well, they send me letters offering to help me.
I get a lot of those too. We must be on the same listserv for psychiatrists. But, you know, I take the point of Sarajevans and people in any besieged situation is they just don't have the time and circumstance for that. And so they block it off. But in a way, animals, of course, have a way of piercing our emotions and making us smile and making us bend down and eliciting our concern in a way that the people around us don't. I mean, Irena, you know, she also will not permit herself immediately to evince a sense of loss when she sees one of her teammates on the old number 3 Grbavica High School basketball team sees her body killed. But it does get under her skin. And my mother-in-law, who was a grandmother on my wife's side of the family, said, Oscotte, she's French, Oscotte, I really think that she should have been a little more sad over the death of her grandmother, you know? And I said, well, Marie-Amélie, and we went through this whole discussion. And I said, it's not that she didn't value the grandmother, but I'm afraid to a teenager, you know, teenagers probably grow up thinking, well, grandmothers at some point leave us. That's harder to accept with a contemporary.
1-800-423-8255. Scott Simon's my guest. We're talking about his book, Pretty Birds, to Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Nan's on the line. Hello, Nan.
Hi. I'm a graduate student here in Boston, and one of my professors uses novels. I'm a graduate student in religion in her comparative religion classes, and she uses them because she thinks that students will be able to suspend their realities to a certain extent that they can't when they read nonfiction. And I was just wondering if you wrote the book with that in mind, and that is your purpose, because I really feel that the war in Bosnia didn't enter Americans' consciousness in ways that that presented it as the emotional travesty that it was.
Yes, I think that was on my mind, and no doubt reaching a new and different kind of audience. I mean, I hope people will buy Pretty Birds who may not ever buy at this point in their lives a nonfiction book, even a great one about the war in Bosnia, but might buy a book about a couple of teenage girls who listen to rock music and fool around with boys and find themselves in an unimaginable situation. I mean, I hope to reach a different kind of audience with a novel too, because you know, in the end, that's satisfying when you're the novelist, when you're the so-called artist, and I also think it's a way of getting the story out and making it alive for more people. So that was absolutely on my mind.
What's your experience, Nan? I mean, if you have a prof who's been handing you novels to say, look, read this, see if this gets you any closer, does it make a difference? Does it work?
It definitely does, in my experience. I'm a student of history, and I'll also be a high school teacher of history. And in my experience, especially studying different cultures, and especially studying religion, it just helps me suspend my own reality to a certain extent that nonfiction really has not been able to do. And so I am going to take this, you know, into my classrooms and use it. And I want to check out this book because all the nonfiction that I've read really has not touched me in a way that fiction has been able to.
Thanks for your call, Nan. It was nice to have you. I'm interested, Scott, you've been back to Sarajevo since that time, right?
Yeah, about a year and a half ago. I hadn't been there since the siege, and my wife had never been there. And we went there and enjoyed it, yes. It was quite moving to be back there.
Has the city regained its kind of easygoing, espresso-sipping, cigarette-smoking, multicultural savoir-faire, or what did you see?
Yeah, to a great degree, it has. It's a smaller city than it was before the war, and no doubt about it, ethnic lines have hardened. That's utterly true. There are Muslims who were very secular before the war, who thought of themselves as European, and who feel as if Europe turned its back on them and didn't treat them as Europeans, but treat them as some kind of threatening Muslim horde in the heart of Europe. And so Iran has built a couple of trophy mosques. The Saudis have built a couple of trophy mosques. And so there is more kind of hardline Islam In the city than there was before, but still, you know, doesn't seem to cut down on the beer or slivovitz or wine consumption, and it's still a secular espresso sipping kind of place that's intensely interested in contemporary affairs. You do see ghosts whenever you walk around, and I think Sarajevans do. Anybody really above the age of 15 or 16 has very vivid memories of that time, and comparatively few of the buildings that were shattered, and there was almost not a building in Sarajevo that was not damaged in some way by artillery or sniper fire. Very few have been rebuilt. The Parliament building that was destroyed and gutted, which is right in the heart of downtown, has not been repaired at all, and it's kind of a living symbol of blight. Whereas the old National Library has been restored. The Holiday Inn Dick has been restored, and there's electricity and water in there, which there wasn't during the siege. I couldn't get over it. But, you know, I had the nicest moment, though, when we were in Old Town, my wife and I, the brewery, the Sarajevo Brewery, which was kept open during the war.
Figures prominently in your book as a munitions plant at the same time.
It does, as headquarters for resistance, because as one of my characters says, you know, the United Nations is interested. They believe that beer is an important part of our culture, and they're more interested in the survival of our culture than they are of our mere lives. And in any event, the Sarajevo Brewery is an important character. We were having dinner one night in Old Town, my wife and I, last night in Sarajevo, and we were served our beverage in Sarajevo Brewery glasses. And my wife said, Western style, oh, it's so important to my husband in this book that he is writing. Could we possibly buy it from you? And the waiter said, no, you can't buy it. No, you can't buy it. To make a long story short, we paid the bill, and he presented us with that brewery glass all wrapped up in a package for us. So we couldn't buy it from him.
But it had to be a gift, right?
As a gift. Had to be a gift. And it reminded me so much of why I cherished the people in Sarajevo so much, because they didn't want charity. They didn't want philanthropy. They simply wanted to be permitted to live their own lives and for that matter, to fight for their own survival without interference from the world. And when we were walking through Sarajevo that night with an old friend, you know, I kept going. I would see this store or that store, and I would say to my wife, this is new, this is new, this is new. A group of kids, I'd say about 5 or 6 years old, ran by us, and our friend Hummel just reached his hands down and patted them on the head and looked at me and said, the children, they are new too. And, you know, and I fell in love with Sarajevo all over again.
Scott, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the program talking about the book.
My pleasure. Thank you, Dick. Thank you.
Scott Simon is host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday and author of a novel about his time in Sarajevo. It's called Pretty Birds. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.